Well, good afternoon, everybody, or good morning, depending on where you are. It's time for session four of Austrian Economics for Managers, and it's a great pleasure to be with you guys again today. I look forward to talking to you about firm boundaries, right? So we talked a little bit about the basics of demand. We talked about production, cost, and entrepreneurship. Then we spent some time discussing firm strategy. In this lecture and in the two lectures that follow, we'll talk a little bit more specifically about issues inside the firm, right? So first of all, how do we decide what kinds of activities should be conducted inside the firm and which activities should be conducted outside or between firms? That's the topic of firm boundaries for today. And then in the 2 weeks that follow, we'll look at some different aspects of internal organization. How should I design my firm so that the people, my people, will do, you know, what we all want to do? How do we coordinate our behavior? How do we structure incentives? How do we reward people and so forth? So let's go ahead and jump right in to this week's topic, which is namely the boundaries of the firm. Now, let me begin by reminding you that there are a few different ways to think about a business firm or a business entity, right? In a lot of standard undergraduate level economics courses, or for that matter, graduate level economics courses that are based on so-called neoclassical economics rather than the Austrian tradition, the firm is viewed entirely as a kind of mechanistic production unit, right? So, you know, there's no people. The firm might as well just be a machine. And you can stick inputs into one end of the machine, land, labor, capital, raw materials, and so forth. And then out of the other end of the machine comes the output, automobiles, or coffee cups, or educational services, or entertainment, or whatever it might be. And those of you who suffered through these kinds of courses in college, right, might be familiar with lots of these different mathematical diagrams. Right. What I have on the slide here is a picture of a production function that might be taken from a standard textbook with the horizontal axis representing, in this case, the amount of capital or the ratio of capital to labor, and the vertical axis representing some kind of output measure here, output divided by the quantity of labor. And there's some attempt to describe the mathematical relationship between these inputs and outputs. I mean, right away you can understand that this is a highly stylized, you know, aggregate notion of a firm, right? I mean, so it's as if you can measure all of the capital that's used in production, right? Capital, remember, in the Austrian sense, refers to capital goods, machines, different types of, you know, buildings, equipment, tools, raw materials and so forth, which are heterogeneous, right? So it's not even clear how would a firm measure its total K, its total capital, as one number. I mean, you could measure, you could look, you know, use a balance sheet, financial measure. You could look at the dollar value of your capital, right? But there could be a lot of substantive changes in the composition of your capital goods that would not be reflected in the total, in the change in the total dollar value of your capital. So looking at aggregates like the capital labor ratio used by the firm or the output to labor ratio used by the firm are not likely to be useful, especially to an entrepreneur or a manager who's concerned with heterogeneity, not just heterogeneity among the firm's assets, but heterogeneity among firms, right? I don't want to be just another airline company. I want to be the best airline company. I want to be better than my rivals. So as we discussed before, a business firm in the Austrian perspective is better conceived in terms of the resources that are owned by the entrepreneur, right? So rather than thinking of the firm as a production function, let's think about the firm as a bundle of assets. And the question of the boundaries of the firm, right, what's inside the firm and what's outside the firm, can be understood in terms of ownership. Right here, I mean the legal sense of ownership, and there's an economic meaning to ownership, which we'll be discussing as we go as well, right? In other words, a business firm is a capitalist entrepreneur, could be a group of capitalist entrepreneurs, plus the alienable assets the capitalist entrepreneur owns, right? Remember, by alienable, we mean assets that you can buy and sell in markets, right? So if you want to think of workers as assets or a worker's knowledge, so-called human capital, as an asset, that is not owned by the firm, right? The firm does not own the worker's knowledge. The firm rents the services of the worker, and the worker owns his own body and his own mind and so forth, right? So the firm is the capitalist entrepreneur plus the land, the building, the machines, the inventory, right? Assets that can be bought and sold on markets. Ownership conveys authority, right? Meaning that, you know, it does matter whether an asset is owned by this entrepreneur or owned by some other entrepreneur. Ownership conveys the right to determine how the asset will be used. And under conditions of uncertainty, right, ownership is very important, and ownership cannot be specified completely ahead of time in some kind of a contract, right? So when push comes to shove, who gets to decide how this machine will be used, how these resources will be combined, what activities will be performed by the firm? Well, that's the role of the owner of the enterprise. You know, another problem with this sort of production function notion of the firm is that, you know, even if it made sense to describe a particular production process using this kind of language, you know, think of an assembly line as a production process. And, you know, to use my favorite example, maybe there's an assembly line that produces styrofoam cups. And maybe it wouldn't make sense in some contexts to talk about the land, labor, and capital that go into producing cups and the amount of cups that come off the assembly line, and maybe we could collect the data and try to estimate some kind of production function that translates these inputs into outputs. But that would have very little to do with the firm or the enterprise as a legal entity, right? I mean, a single firm, Peter Klein Incorporated, could have many different production processes going on inside the firm, right? I might make styrofoam cups, and I might also make ceramic mugs, and I might also make paper boxes and so forth. So just knowing the characteristics of a production process would not necessarily tell me much about the firm in which those production activities are taking place. Likewise, two or more independent firms could set up a joint venture to produce styrofoam cups. So it might be Peter Klein Inc. and Danny Sanchez Inc. are jointly operating this assembly line. So if we want to know, why do we have a Peter Klein Inc.? What's the profitability of Peter Klein Inc. relative to Danny Sanchez Inc.? Right? What's the growth path of Peter Klein's firm? Will Peter Klein's firm be taken over by another firm? Will it go bankrupt? How many employees will Peter hire? How will Peter govern his operations? Simply knowing the sort of engineering data on the production of styrofoam cups is not likely to be particularly helpful. So, you know, let's theorize a little bit about the business firm. You know, what is a firm and why do we have firms and so forth? The classic sort of best known framework for analyzing these questions comes from a famous economist named Ronald Coase, who died just this past year at the age of 102, I think. Coase wrote a very famous paper in 1937 called The Nature of the Firm, and it's described in some of the readings, several of the readings for this week, which hopefully you've taken a look at, framing the problem. Why do we have business firms? What determines their boundaries? And how should firms be organized internally? So Coase's answer for the question of why firms exist is to invoke transaction costs, what Coase called the costs of exchange. So what Coase means is, again, going back to my styrofoam cup example, there could be a firm, Peter Klein Inc., that produces styrofoam cups and other goods maybe, right? So that means that Peter Klein Inc. procures the labor that's necessary, purchases the raw materials, acquires the equipment, the machines, and so forth that are used to produce the styrofoam cups. So the customer simply coordinates, or the customer deals with me, Peter Klein, gives me money in exchange for cups. Right? You can imagine another kind of model for producing styrofoam cups, a highly decentralized kind of, you know, independent contractor model where there is no firm producing cups, right? There are cup workers, and there are owners of big sheets of styrofoam, and there are owners of machines that can be used to shape styrofoam and so forth. And if I want a styrofoam cup to use, right, I have to negotiate with, you know, I find some guy who owns one of those cup machines, and I say, hey, can I use your machine for 15 seconds? And I pay him, and we sign a contract and so forth. Then I go to a guy who owns a big block of styrofoam, and I offer to buy so much styrofoam and to have it delivered to the guy who owns the machine. And then I contract with a worker who knows how to operate the machine, and I independently negotiate with each of those inputs, and then the inputs have to sort of coordinate amongst themselves, and using that, they end up, you know, we end up with one styrofoam cup. But think of that as sort of a Wikipedia model, no central authority, just a fully decentralized, disaggregated, independent contractor model for producing stuff. I mean, look, in principle, you could get a styrofoam cup that way. Right? Maybe there's a new technology. If I have a 3D printer at home and the right inputs, maybe I can make a styrofoam cup all by myself with my own labor and one machine that I own. Right? But in general, trying to produce, you know, all of the complex goods and services that we have in a modern economy by sort of independent, you know, through networks of independent contractors negotiating each time we want to produce one unit of output or one run of output. I mean, that's a lot of negotiation, right? That's a lot of transacting in Coase's language. And if there are some costs to transacting, right? I mean, finding people to trade with and negotiating with them over price and making sure that they deliver on time and, you know, going to the courts or filing a lawsuit if they fail to deliver what they promise. I mean, that ends up taking a lot of time and energy. Right? It is costly to engage in those transactions. Just, again, the negotiation and the searching for people and the enforcing agreements, etc. That's what Coase referred to as transaction costs. Right? If those costs are significant, just in the opportunity cost sense of using a lot of our time, then it may make more sense for one agent, an entrepreneur owner, a capitalist entrepreneur in my language, to kind of handle the coordination for us. Right, so the customer just negotiates with the entrepreneur, who then subcontracts all these other tasks. Right, if you've ever built a house, you understand that the buyer typically wants to negotiate with an agent we call a contractor, right, who then delegates all of the other stuff and subcontracts with all of the other agents. Right, so the building contractor, he's an expert in dealing with a roofer and a plumber and an electrician and so forth. And he can get those people, he can find the right ones, he can get them to play nicely with each other much more effectively than I can, because he does that every day for a living. So if you like, in Coase's sense, the owner of a firm, the operator of a firm, the key decision maker in a business firm, is just kind of like a coordinating agent who deals with all of the individual input providers as kind of subcontractors. That's why we have, you know, General Motors or Microsoft or Peter Klein Styrofoam Cup Inc., because it's simply less costly to have activities coordinated internally by particular agents. In my own writings on the firm, building not only on Coase but also on Frank Knight's theory of entrepreneurship, which we discussed two lectures ago, you know, I would answer the same question in a slightly different way, right? The decisions that the entrepreneur makes about what resources to acquire and how to combine them, all of the knowledge and judgment that goes into the production of goods and services, right? That is something that cannot itself be delegated to somebody else. So if a firm is an entrepreneur plus a set of assets, right, the reason that entrepreneurs take possession of assets is because we need somebody to have the sort of ultimate residual decision rights over how those assets will be used. That person is the owner slash entrepreneur. So we have firms because entrepreneurs cannot buy and sell judgment in the market, Rather, the way one exercises judgment is by buying and selling assets, alienable resources. So firms or entrepreneurs, plus the assets that those entrepreneurs have acquired and that the entrepreneurs are responsible for combining and deploying and maintaining and so forth. Many people in the Austrian literature have referred more specifically to Hayek's notion of tacit knowledge, right? It's not original to Hayek, but sort of popularized by Hayek, this idea that it's difficult for people to explicitly communicate various bits of knowledge or information, that these are done rather through kind of frequent interaction, through impersonal mechanisms, sometimes mediated through prices in the market, but other times mediated through sort of close physical proximity. And some of you may be familiar with the literature in strategic management, building on Edith Penrose, thinking of firms as sort of repositories of tacit knowledge, the firm as a locus of tacit routines and capabilities, or a sort of a platform within which a charismatic leader can influence other people by communicating tacit knowledge through various sort of frequent ongoing kinds of day-to-day interaction. I think that's also an important element to what the firm is, although I tend to think that the question of whether we can exchange tacit knowledge through a contract between firms or whether it needs to be exchanged within a firm is sort of a separate question that we would still need to address. So what determines the boundary of a firm from this general perspective? Well, it has to do, in Coase's terminology, with the relative costs of transacting internally and externally. Right, remember, again, my example of building a house. Right. If it's the case that a particular type of house or building is constructed very frequently and there's some standardization in the procedures, it might make sense for the contractor to set up a construction firm and the plumber and the roofer and the electrician and so forth become the contractor's regular employees. And instead of negotiating over every job, right? If I'm the contractor, I'm the house builder. We have Klein Custom Homes, Inc. Right? I have my own in-house plumber who's my employee, and I hire him to work for me for a certain period of time under certain conditions where we don't specify ahead of time exactly what he will do every day. I just say, hey, you're going to show up for work every day and perform whatever plumbing tasks I ask you to perform. Likewise with my engineers and my electricians, and maybe I have some administrative assistants and finance people who have very general roles. I say, just come into the office and do whatever I want you to do that particular day. Rather than negotiating task by task, it may make more sense to combine those activities inside a firm and economize on those contracting costs, right? So if the costs of dealing with these people on a task-by-task basis, of arranging things on a task-by-task basis, are relatively high, are high relative to the cost of dealing with employees inside a company, right? Then it makes sense for the company to expand. And the electrician who was formerly an arm's-length contractor becomes a regular employee. At the same time, right, as most of you know, if you've ever been in a management position or if you've been in any kind of organization, you know that dealing with employees is not costless either. You have to motivate your employees. You have to incentivize your employees. You have to monitor and evaluate your employees. And it may be that you find that given the particular circumstances that you're in, right, the costs of dealing with employees, the cost of coordinating activities inside the firm's boundary, are actually higher than the cost of dealing with independent contractors on an arm's length basis, right? And in a case like that, you would decide, hey, I've got too many activities inside my firm. I need to contract some of them out. I need to outsource those activities, right? So Coase's argument is not saying firms should be large, nor is it saying firms should be small. It's saying whether the firm is large or small depends on the circumstances, right? And the entrepreneur is constantly evaluating the decision, should I, integrate one more transaction or one less at the margin? And I make that decision by evaluating the relative costs of transacting externally and internally, and I make that decision. Okay, you know, you might also think of this in terms of entrepreneurial talent, right? I mean, not only is judgment not contractible, meaning that you have to have a firm to exercise judgment in this commercial sense, but also judgment doesn't expand sort of infinitely, right? I mean, there are only so many entrepreneurs with so many skills, and they can only coordinate certain activities, not an infinite number of activities, right? So what activities are inside the firm and what activities are outside the firm, right, are you know, determined by the skills of the entrepreneur, the ability of the entrepreneur to exercise judgment. And as we'll discuss in just a moment, Mises' calculation problem also imposes some specific limits on the firm. This is some analysis that was offered by Rothbard, which we'll talk about in more detail in just a second. What we'll be talking about in weeks 5 and 6 has to do with a related question. You know, given that a firm exists and given that it is organized, given that it is a certain size, not larger, not smaller, you know, how should the activities be organized inside the firm? And this has to do with the delegation of authority from the capitalist entrepreneur to subordinates, right? How will decision authority be distributed within the firm? How will employees who have certain kinds of decision authority be monitored and evaluated? Okay, but today we're going to talk about boundaries, right? And I can see the chat window as we go. There's some interesting questions about transaction costs and whether there's sort of, some sort of conceptual confusion maybe around the concept of transaction costs, and I'm going to address those issues as we go, specifically Rothbard's comments about transaction costs. I think Rothbard, to give you a preview, I think the analysis that I'm presenting here is 100% Rothbardian and is thoroughly consistent with the analysis that Rothbard provides in his own work on the firm. But we'll get to that in a little bit more detail in just a second. Okay, just some definitions, right? In the literature on the economics of the firm, the strategy of the firm, right? It's common to distinguish between vertical, horizontal, and what we might call conglomerate boundaries, right? So vertical boundaries refers to, Menger's structure of production, the Austrian structure of production, or the supply chain in modern terminology, right? So a vertically integrated firm is one that in which the entrepreneur owns resources used for activities at multiple points in the supply chain, right? So going back to my styrofoam cup example, a company that produces styrofoam cups but also produces, blocks of styrofoam that can then be molded into cups, right, would be a vertically integrated firm. Whereas a firm that only makes cups but purchases the materials, the blocks of styrofoam, on the open market would be not vertically integrated in this sense. Horizontal boundaries refer to kind of the size of the firm within a given market segment. So should I be produce 1,000 styrofoam cups per day or 10,000 cups per day or 1,000,000 cups per day, right? Should I operate only in New York City, or only in Los Angeles, or throughout the entire United States, or on a global scale? Conglomerate boundaries refers to diversification, either geographic or more commonly across product categories, right? So here the question is, should a firm that makes styrofoam cups also make computer chips and also make hamburgers, right? Or should it only concentrate on styrofoam cups? Or should it diversify only more narrowly and produce, say, styrofoam cups and styrofoam boxes? Okay, so we'll talk a little bit, we'll talk mainly about vertical integration, vertical boundaries, a little bit about horizontal boundaries, and then in the time that remains, we'll talk about diversification or conglomerate boundaries. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the vertical stages of production. So as trained Austrian scholars, you're already familiar with Menger's distinctions between higher order goods and lower order goods, right? That the styrofoam cup that I actually used to take a drink of water is a lower order or consumer good, but it in itself is the result of, you know, many, many stages of production. The cups are made by machines and specialized labor, and they use certain raw materials. But those styrofoam cup machines must be produced in an earlier stage of production, and the styrofoam block must be manufactured in an earlier stage of production. And then the raw materials that go into the manufacture of the styrofoam must be procured at yet a higher stage of production, and so on. We can sort of trace this all the way back to the what Rothbard calls the originary factors that the land and labor that itself are sort of at the start of the whole process. So the question is, you know, should the Styrofoam Cup Company focus on manufacturing the cups out of styrofoam that is produced somewhere else, or should the cup company also make the styrofoam blocks? So maybe one way to think about this is to start by saying, well, what are the benefits of being specialized? In other words, what are the benefits of outsourcing, you know, the procurement of the styrofoam and the production of the machines that are used to make the cups and so forth to other firms? The reason for starting there is that, if you're familiar with economics, Austrian economics in particular, right, we know all about the advantages of specialization and the division of labor, right? Adam Smith described the division of labor, but this was really emphasized by Mises, right? Some of you may remember that in Human Action, Mises describes the exchange relationship as the most fundamental of all human relationships. What distinguishes human society from, you know, an ant colony or something is that we purposefully engage in specialization, trade, and an advanced division of labor. The principle of comparative advantage developed by Ricardo and also emphasized by Mises, you know, shows how everybody has a role to play in the division of labor, regardless of how skilled you may be in particular activities, right? But just thinking about it that way, you know, your immediate reaction is to say, you know, vertical integration sounds inefficient, right? I mean, if Peter Klein is really skilled at coordinating the process for manufacturing styrofoam cups, you know, the process of taking various chemicals and molding them into big blocks of styrofoam, that's an entirely different business, right? And the activity of producing machines that are used to make styrofoam cups, I mean, that is also a completely different kind of manufacturing process. Shouldn't Klein focus on the thing in which he has a real comparative advantage and then let other entrepreneurs who have a comparative advantage in making styrofoam blocks or making styrofoam cup machines, let them specialize in the things in which they have a comparative advantage, and we'll all be better off, you know, through exchange. Just like the old, you know, models of comparative advantage where, you know, the UK specializes in bread and France specializes in wine, and both the British and the French can be better off through specialization and free trade, rather than each country trying to be self-sufficient, right? So if you're familiar with the advantages of why we should have international trade rather than self-sufficiency within a country, you might think that argument scales down to the firm, right? Why not have free trade among firms, right? Let firms, let entrepreneurs specialize in the things that they're really good at and let them trade with other entrepreneurs who are equally skilled and equally specialized. So you might think an economy with a lot of small, vertically specialized firms would be the most efficient one. You know, just as we discussed in week two, you know, we would have all of these intermediate goods, all these inputs would be bought and sold in competitive markets where their prices are equal to their discounted marginal revenue products. And entrepreneurs can perform what Mises calls economic calculation. The entrepreneur at each stage can figure out exactly what to do and how best to do it by comparing the prices of different kinds of factors and factor combinations against the receipts that he'll receive from selling his product, where in this case his product may not be a consumer good, but just a slightly more, you know, something that's slightly lower down in the vertical structure of production. In other words, what I'm saying to you guys is that from an Austrian point of view, you know, vertical integration seems like a puzzle. It seems like an anomaly. It seems like maybe central planning. It seems like a deviation from the free market, right? Having an entrepreneur who deliberately, administratively coordinates multiple stages of production and tells the higher stage to do this and then deliver your components to the next stage and they'll do something and then they'll deliver their stuff to the next stage. I mean, that sounds like the Politburo, you know, running things. Is that a violation of free market principles or Austrian principles? Well, indeed, many people think that, you know, if we ever see firms in the real economy that are doing that are vertically integrated, right, it must be there must be some weird tax issue or some kind of regulatory issue or something like that. I'm just going to pause for just a moment. Is everybody receiving the lecture? If you can hear me, Bruce is saying he can't get the lecture for some reason. So I'm addressing this to Bruce. People are asking when it starts. Let's see. Yeah, okay, so this message goes out to Bruce. I think, Bruce, you may be having some technical difficulty, but okay. Well, I was maybe nervous there because I've just given 30 minutes of the best talk I've ever given, and I was afraid maybe I was lecturing into the ether. But okay, Danny, maybe you can work with Bruce offline to figure out whatever problem he might be having. So. Okay, where was I? Oh, yeah. So some people might say, gosh, if you see a vertically integrated firm, you know, it must be government intervention somehow, right? It, you know, maybe there's a tax advantage to vertical integration, particularly if I have activities that are located in different countries. You know, if my supplier is in Mexico and I'm in the U.S., then maybe if I'm vertically integrated, I can... you know, depending on the transfer prices, I can shift income between my Mexican subsidiary and my U.S. parent, and I can lower my overall tax burden somehow, right? Or maybe there's some regulatory thing. Maybe there is some a government regulation that concerns exchanging blocks of styrofoam in the market, and if I vertically integrate, then I'm just transferring the blocks of styrofoam, you know, from one of my subsidiaries to another. I take that transaction out of the market. I avoid government regulation. You know, it may very well be the case. It may very well be the case that there are particular activities. There may be particular cases in which a firm boundary decision is driven by some tax or regulatory issue. But I don't think that's a very good explanation for vertical boundaries in general, right? If we want to understand particular industries. Right? Why does this industry tend to be vertically integrated over these stages and this other industry tends not to be? If we want to look at maybe an industry over time, right? That the computer industry in the 1950s and 1960s and 70s tended to be a very vertically integrated business. If you look at, you know, IBM or the big mainframe companies, you know, they manufactured all the components, the processor, the memory, and so forth. They assembled the mainframes, they delivered the mainframes and installed them at the client site, they performed the after-sale service, and so forth. You know, compare that to the highly vertically disintegrated model that prevails today, right? Whether it's, you know, desktop or laptop computers, most of the computer makers like Dell, right, are just assemblers. They don't manufacture, you know, they buy the memory from Intel or AMD, and they buy the disk drive from some Korean manufacturer and so forth. Or if you want to look at handheld devices, right, you know, that's not only do companies like Samsung outsource a lot of the component manufacturing, but Samsung, in most cases, doesn't even deal directly with the consumer, right? They sell to a wireless service company, Verizon or AT&T or Orange or whatever, which then deals with the consumer. So the computer industry, whether it's mobiles or handhelds or whatever, or laptops, is highly disintegrated today. It was much more vertically integrated in the past. I don't think you can explain that trend in terms of tax and regulatory changes, right? That's more has to do with changes in technology, the increase in modularity, changes in business practices and so forth. So I think, well, you know, we don't want, we need to look beyond tax and regulatory intervention to explain overall trends in vertical integration and outsourcing. Now, some strategy scholars, like Michael Porter, who we discussed extensively last week, building on the neoclassical tradition in economics, have emphasized the notion of market power or monopoly power, right? Rents and Alfred Marshall's sense that, well, the way for a firm to be profitable is to be able to extract consumer surplus from the customers, to be able to erect entry barriers and so forth. And if a firm is, has some kind of monopoly power, it may be able to leverage that monopoly power or exploit that monopoly power more effectively by leveraging its monopoly position in one segment into other segments of the market, right? So look at the Microsoft antitrust case of the 1990s, right? The argument was that Microsoft, you know, has a so-called monopoly on desktop personal computers, and therefore Microsoft could integrate backwards into the browser market, right? Microsoft could not only produce the PC and the operating system, but also the browser, right, rather than purchasing the browser from another company like Netscape, right? And some of you young people don't know what I'm talking about, but in the old days, you had the Netscape browser was the dominant internet browser. Actually, Mosaic was even older than that. And then Microsoft came along with Internet Explorer, and one of the antitrust issues in the 90s in this big Microsoft case was whether Microsoft was using its so-called monopoly of the desktop to sort of squeeze out Netscape, right, and, you know, to sort of install Internet Explorer by default on the PC, and so the user would see the little Internet Explorer icon on the desktop, and by refusing to put Netscape Navigator on the desktop, right, Microsoft was supposedly using its monopoly in the operating system market, right, to give itself monopoly power in the browser, the upstream browser software market. There are a number of reasons why that analysis is not correct, which we can discuss, you know, offline or on the discussion threads or whatever. But, you know, you can see if you believe, as Porter does, that competitive advantage comes from exploiting monopoly power, then a powerful firm would want to try to get as much monopoly power as it can elsewhere in the supply chain. Another famous example here is in the aluminum industry, where Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of America, early in the 20th century, in a famous antitrust case, right, was accused of trying to dominate the entire market by purchasing aluminum mines, right, or by purchasing mines that were making the ores used to produce aluminum. So the idea is, you know, Alcoa already had a very large market share, so-called monopoly, in making aluminum foil and aluminum components, right? If they also buy out all of the mines producing the inputs into aluminum, then no other firm could possibly compete with them. They could control the entire supply chain. So that's one family of explanations for why firms might vertically integrate. You know, it's not about regulation or the tax code or whatever. You know, it's about increasing one's profit by exploiting market power. Now, for reasons that we've already discussed and most of you are familiar with already, you know, there are a lot of sort of problems with the whole construct of monopoly power or monopoly privilege in the neoclassical sense, right? Dynamic competition, the sort of constant churn from entrepreneurial innovation and so forth. From an Austrian point of view, unless the monopoly is a legal monopoly, you know, a government-issued license or patent, some sort of, you know, legally binding barrier to other firms coming into the market, then it's not really relevant as a source of sustainable competitive advantage. Let me talk briefly about arguments that are sort of based on Coase's thought and really elaborated more fully by Oliver Williamson, a famous American economist who won the Nobel Prize in 2009, which uses arguments about transaction costs to explain why firms might integrate vertically. Right, and the basic story builds on the analysis that we discussed on the previous slide. right? You start with COSA's framework, that there are costs of outsourcing or procuring components on the market. There are also costs of producing components internally, and the firm wants to sort of balance, or the entrepreneur is trying to weigh the marginal benefits and marginal costs of each organizational alternative to decide what makes most sense in a particular case. Williamson emphasized a particular kind of transaction cost that occurs when you're outsourcing productive activities and dealing with a particular kind of heterogeneous resource. So while Williamson does not build explicitly on Austrian capital theory, he does frame his analysis around a specific kind of resource heterogeneity, what Williamson calls asset specificity. And so asset specificity in this context refers to resources, machines, production processes, capital goods, tools, and so forth, that are specialized not for particular uses, but specialized to particular users. In other words, in my example with the styrofoam cups, suppose that Peter Klein Inc. Manufactures a particular kind of styrofoam cup, and say that this cup is really distinct in some way, you know, the shape or the thickness or the design is somehow unique. I'm the only one who sells a styrofoam cup with these particular qualities, so that you can't just use any generic machine to make them, right? So imagine, you know, it's not the case that there's like a 3D printer that can efficiently make any kind of cup. But to produce the Peter Klein cups, you have to have a very specialized kind of machine, right? And if I'm the only one making the Peter Klein cups, and I go to Danny Sanchez and I say, hey, Sanchez, you know, you own a company that makes industrial machines, right? I want you to manufacture these machines that are specific to Peter Klein's cup company, right? So I want you, Sanchez, to invest in your own capital goods to make machines that you will sell to Peter Klein. And I'm the only one who uses these particular, I'm the only one who sells these cups, so I'm the only one who will buy these machines from you. Now off you go, you know, go set up your plant and your factory and hire a lot of workers and train them and acquire a lot of capital to service my needs. And, you know, we'll work out the payment details later. Now, Sanchez is no fool, right? I mean, there's no way he would agree to that. Sanchez is thinking, now, wait a minute. Klein is asking me to make all of these investments in making machines that only Peter Klein can use, or only Peter Klein, you know, can make reasonable use of, right? That's going to cost me a lot of money. Once I've made all those investments, then Klein's going to come along and he's going to try to negotiate a low price. Right, or he's going to say, oh, yeah, Sanchez, I told you I would pay, you know, $1,500 for each one of those machines. I'm sorry, I can only afford $1,000, or I can only afford, you know, half that $750. Take it or leave it. Now, from Sanchez's point of view, right, he's already invested. He's built a factory to build the machines for Peter Klein. If Peter Klein walks away and says, no, forget it, I won't pay that price, I'm gone, then Sanchez is left with all this stuff. I mean, it has some value. There's some salvage value. He can reconfigure his plant to produce machines that he can sell to Bob Murphy, but at a cost, right? So if I know this, right, I know that I can jerk him around a little bit on the price. In other words, the more general point is that if you invest in assets that are specific to one particular trading partner, if you have a lot of relationship-specific investment, what Williamson calls asset specificity, right? Then you run the danger that your trading partners will try to take advantage of that fact. You put yourself in an unfavorable bargaining position. The term that Williamson uses for this, you know, jerking your trading partner around, is hold up. In other words, if I go to Sanchez and I say, okay, now that you've made all these investments that are specific to your relationship with me, I will threaten to end the relationship unless you agree to renegotiate the terms of trade in a way that is beneficial to me. And I know exactly how hard I can go on that, you know, knowing how much you've invested in the relationship. That would be me holding up Sanchez, trying to hold up Sanchez. in Williamson's terminology. Now, again, Sanchez is no fool, you know, by assumption. Is he in there listening? Okay, yeah, he is. He really is no fool. So Sanchez might say to me at the very beginning of the process, okay, Klein, I see what you're trying to do here. I understand the kind of relationship that we want to have, but you know, I'm no idiot. I'm not gonna do all this stuff before you've paid me, right? Or at least before you've agreed legally, contractually, to buy a certain number of machines from me at a certain price, right? So Sanchez will ask for a contract, and he and I will negotiate and say, oh, I'll say, okay, yeah, I promise to buy this many machines from you at this price over this period of time. And maybe we can negotiate terms that make him happy, that satisfy him that he's protected against opportunistic behavior, opportunistic holdup on my part, right? But in a world of genuine uncertainty, in a world of Knightian uncertainty and not mere probabilistic risk, it's not likely that we can write a contract that covers every possible contingency, right? There are all sorts of conditions that might arise, unexpected changes in market conditions, changes in technology, an earthquake, a natural disaster, a change in government regulation or the tax code, some crazy thing that Janet Yellen does, right, or that the European Central Bank does or whatever. There are all sorts of potential contingencies that we can't really anticipate well enough to specify them in the contract, right? So, or to put it another way, any contract that would cover all possible contingencies would be so large and unwieldy and inflexible that it, you know, we either couldn't write it or it wouldn't make sense to try to write a contract like that. It would cost too much to try to produce and enforce a contract like that. In the language of transaction cost theory, all feasible contracts are incomplete, right? Meaning they have some gaps or holes in them. There's some circumstance that might arise if uncertainties are, you know, significant, in which our contract doesn't apply, and then we're back to renegotiation, and Sanchez is at the risk of being held up, right? So it may be that if the level, the required or desired amount of asset specificity is sufficiently high and the uncertainties involved in production are sufficiently large, Sanchez may decide there's just no way to do this with sort of an arm's length contract. If you want these machines, you're going to have to make them yourself, right? So either I have to set up my own, in-house de novo unit to produce these machines, or maybe I just go to Danny and offer to buy him out. Right, I acquire his company, and now I have a vertically integrated company that is, you know, controls both of the two stages. Right, so the idea is that firms will tend to vertically integrate, or we will expect to see production vertically integrated as a way of solving potential holdup problems that result from investments in relationship-specific assets. Now, again, the claim is not that all production processes should be vertically integrated for this reason, right? But that production will be vertically integrated under certain conditions, right? Where there is a significant amount of asset specificity, where there is a significant amount of uncertainty, and so on, right? Williamson describes it in the following way, right? That you can imagine there are different ways to sort of organize economic activities, right? Think of sort of a spectrum with vertical integration at one extreme, and just sort of spot market procurement as needed procurement at the other extreme, and then a bunch of sort of what Williamson calls hybrids in the middle, long-term contracts and maybe franchise networks, joint ventures, and so on, where you have some deliberate coordination but something less than full vertical integration. Williamson's claim is that, you know, the greater the degree of relationship-specific investment or asset specificity, the more likely production will be found at the vertical integration end of the scale, right? So you're trying to sort of match the characteristics of production, the characteristics of the transactions involved in production, with the way you organize or own or govern that production process. So, you know, this is a very short summary of ideas that are developed in Williamson's very famous books, like Markets and Hierarchies from 1975, The Economic Institutions of Capitalism from 1985, and some of his more recent works as well. A couple years ago, I edited a book called The Elgar Companion to Transaction Cost Economics, which unfortunately is not free. You have to buy it from Edward Elgar, but it has a number of chapters sort of summarizing different aspects of this transaction cost approach. Now, I hope that you enjoyed the little article by Varian, right? And that article is, I mean, it's not brand new, right? It's several years old, but it was written by Varian sort of when people first started to think about the impact of the internet on production. And I'll also come back to this point at the very end of the lecture, too. But, you know, a lot of people have said in the last decade or so that, okay, yeah, all this stuff from people like Coase and Williamson, it's fine. It makes sense. It might have made sense in the 19th century and the 20th century. But this whole notion that transacting is costly is very old-fashioned. I mean, yeah, it might have been costly to find, you know, suppliers and to negotiate with suppliers and to pay your suppliers and so forth when you had to use the phone book or you had to drive around in your car to meet them and sign pieces of paper in different offices with attorneys and so forth. But, you know, now we have the internet. Right? I mean, just as the consumer, can, you know, I can shop on Amazon or eBay and buy anything I want with a couple of mouse clicks and pay through PayPal and so forth. You know, why can't a styrofoam cup manufacturer find as many input suppliers as he wants on some kind of business-to-business, you know, B2B website, and you can, you know, do the contract with a couple of mouse clicks, and you can pay through some sort of commercial version of PayPal or whatever. We really don't need the hierarchical firm anymore. There was a book came out a few years ago by Don Tapscott and Anthony Williams called Wikinomics, How Mass Collaboration Changes Everything. Their claim was that because of the internet and the ability for highly decentralized forms of coordination, like a Wikipedia, right? We can produce styrofoam cups and automobiles and universities and anything by using a sort of decentralized, you know, sort of wiki model. You don't need entrepreneurs owning assets anymore. Everybody can be his own entrepreneur. Everybody can be his own independent contractor, just kind of coordinating through the internet. There's another book that's more of an academic book by another well-known guy named Benkler, Yochai Benkler, called The Wealth of Networks. I wrote a book review. I reviewed it for the Independent Review. It's a very interesting book, but I think this general idea is a little bit misleading, or rather there's a tendency, people who make these kind of arguments, to radically overstate things. I mean, yeah, of course it's true that you know, buying a book on Amazon and downloading it to my Kindle and paying, you know, through PayPal is easier than walking to a local bookshop and browsing through and paying with cash or whatever. Yes, if we have you know, better mobile apps and we have Bitcoin and we have whatever, it does make the cost of transacting in the marketplace low. It does lower those costs. I mean, does it follow then that everybody should be an independent contractor and everything should be produced by what Benkler calls, you know, through the commons? Benkler's term is commons-based peer production. Everything is done in peer-to-peer sort of sharing networks. Well, I mean, maybe, maybe not. As Varian points out, that not only is it true that technology, communications technology, and information technology lowers the cost of transacting between firms, it also lowers the cost of coordinating inside firms, right? It's the cost of managing employees, monitoring employees, sharing information within a company, within a hierarchical firm. Those costs have gone down too, right? I mean, it may very well be that the net effect of information technology is to make firms larger rather than smaller, right? I mean, you have, you know, maybe these big enterprise resource planning systems, PeopleSoft and Oracle and so forth, maybe they have such a strong effect on lowering the cost of internal coordination, that outweighs quantitatively the impact of, you know, PayPal and Amazon on sort of business-to-business transacting. So it may be that we decide to internalize more functions rather than fewer functions. So this notion that the hierarchical firm has been made obsolete by technology, and that now we should only have virtual firms, you know, each of us will be sitting at home with a website, you know, doing business in our pajamas, that's obviously a huge overstatement. I mean, of course, there is room for that kind of enterprise, but by no means is that the only kind of enterprise that a modern economy needs. Okay, in my 96 article on the limits to the firm, right, I sort of deal more specifically with arguments from Mises and Rothbard on the limits to the vertically integrated firm, right? And as Rothbard argued, there are two kinds of limits to how large a firm can be, right? Again, as I mentioned before, you can think of sort of the incremental limits as being related to indivisibilities in the entrepreneur's judgment. I mean, one entrepreneur cannot coordinate an infinite variety of production processes. There are some limits. Rothbard points out that there's sort of an ultimate limit or an upper bound as well that has to do with Mises' calculation problem, right? So what Rothbard is saying following Mises is that as a firm begins to integrate more and more stages of production, it finds it more and more difficult to get good information on how to price exchanges between internal subsidiaries, right? So if I'm making these styrofoam cups and I have my own in-house styrofoam block subsidiary, you know, if there are a lot of other companies out in the larger market that also make styrofoam blocks, then, you know, I can choose my transfer price. You know, what should I bill the downstream assembly division every time it purchases a block of styrofoam from the upstream styrofoam block division? I mean, it's not a real purchase on the market; it's just an accounting entry, right? But I want to have sort of a transfer price that reflects the actual marginal value product or marginal revenue product of the input. I mean, I want my internal transfer prices to reflect DMRPs, just as factor prices and factor markets external to the firm reflect, you know, DMRPs through competition. If there's no competition, if I'm the only user of this kind of styrofoam, you know, then I have to make an educated guess about the transfer price, and that educated guess it's not likely to be as close to the DMRP as you would get if we actually had competition among entrepreneurs in the market. Right, so as I get larger, as external markets for my internally transferred components begin to disappear, right, then my transfer prices get less and less accurate. They have more error in them. They don't reflect DMRPs as well. And so I begin to make mistakes, right? I don't know if my downstream subsidiary is really economically efficient. Maybe I should sell it off instead of keeping it inside. I don't know whether to invest more in styrofoam block manufacture or styrofoam cup assembly. I begin to get more and more like the manager of a socialist enterprise, right? So as long as I could be a very large vertically integrated firm, but as long as I'm operating within a larger competitive market, I still have information from people, you know, from decision makers external to my firm that I can use to make decisions. But the larger I become, the more vertically integrated I become, the less and less accurate are my, you know, is my internal my internal price signals, because I no longer have any external signals. What Rothbard was addressing here is the concern that people expressed in the 50s and 60s that, gosh, if we keep expanding, if we allow firms to be vertically integrated, pretty soon the entire economy will just be one big firm. You know, Walmart Inc. will just simply vertically integrate everything, and there won't be any factor markets whatsoever. Everything will be Walmart. And Rothbard is pointing out we really don't need to worry about that, right? We don't need to, that's not going to happen because there are natural market limits to how strong a vertically integrated Walmart can be, related to the same arguments that Mises made about economic calculation. As Rothbard put it, as these external markets disappear, islands of non-calculable chaos swell to the proportions of masses and continents. I love Rothbard's verbiage, right? As the area of incalculability increases, the degrees of irrationality, misallocation, loss, impoverishment, etc., become greater. So the large vertically integrated firm may begin to suffer from these islands of non-calculable chaos internally, and eventually that just hurts profits, right? Such that a new specialized, less vertically integrated entrant can come in and outcompete the incumbent firm. Just, you know, I should mention, because I think it's important, you know, how this fits into the socialist calculation debate. You know, as many of you know, Mises published his famous article on the impossibility of economic calculation under socialism in 1920. And, of course, the Soviet Union, you know, fell apart in 1990, 1991. But that was quite a long time, you know, 75 or more years. The Soviet Union was kind of plugging along. You know, it wasn't, I mean, as we now know, right, it was never doing that well. It wasn't that healthy. But it didn't sort of, the Soviet economy didn't just sort of collapse overnight. And many people in the 20th century used this as an argument against Mises. They said, well, clearly Mises was wrong. If Mises' argument were correct, then the Soviet Union would have collapsed by 1920 or 1930, yet it managed to make it all the way until, you know, almost the end of the 20th century. Therefore, maybe socialism, you know, isn't quite as efficient as capitalism, but it's certainly not impossible. Rational economic planning under socialism is not impossible, as Mises claimed. As Rothbard points out, the right counter argument is the following, right? The members of the Politburo in 1952, right, if they were, you know, thinking about how they should price steel within the Soviet Union, you know, how much should they you know, charge to a railroad operator, the Soviet railroad operating subsidiary, for the steel that it acquires from a Soviet-owned steel production facility, you know, again, just to do their own internal computations. Well, that was easy to do, even though it was the Soviet Union, right? Because the Politburo member could simply pick up a copy of the Wall Street Journal and turn to the back and find out what is the market price of steel. In other words, what's the price of steel on the world market? Even though there was no steel market internal to the Soviet Union, there were markets external to the Soviet economy. Right, so a Soviet-style central planning regime, it can survive, not maybe very efficiently, but it can survive as long as the entire globe is not one socialist regime. You know, then the whole thing might have collapsed overnight. So as long as the Soviet Union were sort of a little island of socialism in this larger sea of market activity, the central planner could always use external price signals as a proxy for his own sort of internal decision-making. That's kind of what Rothbard is saying here, right? Even Walmart or Microsoft or Google or whatever giant company you want to point to, you know, that's not a Soviet-style system, right? Because that company, no matter how large it is, even though those companies are very large, they still compete with other large companies. And for most of the inputs they procure, there are also external factor markets providing prices that entrepreneurs can use to you know, determine their own sort of factor prices. Okay, well, it's just a little bit past 5:30. I want to be sure and leave plenty of time for questions. So I'm going to skip over some of the material that I had prepared on diversification and let you read that on your own and discuss it in the discussion boards, even though I do have some slides over it. But let me make a couple of other points that I think some of you will find interesting. You know, again, in the Austrian literature, you find a lot of reference, not just to the kinds of things I'm talking about, but, you know, a lot of reference to tacit knowledge and sort of more Hayekian approaches to the firm. There's what Charles Koch in his book on management calls market-based management, sort of the application of Austrian-style principles to managerial problems, you know, trying to make firms as decentralized as possible so that the hierarchy is as much like a market as possible. I mean, there's nothing wrong with organizing firms to try to make effective use of tacit knowledge and, you know, having organizing firms as trying to set up internal markets and allowing negotiation and decentralization where it's appropriate. We'll talk about that a little bit more next week. But there's nothing, you know, uniquely Austrian about that. Or to put it another way, the idea that under some circumstances, a more hierarchical method of production with a lower amount of delegation and more centralized decision authority within the firm, within a privately owned firm, you know, a private property firm, that's not inconsistent with Austrian principles, right? There's nothing about Austrian economics that says firms should never, production should never be hierarchically organized. That's a mistake that I think you sometimes find in Austrian discussions of these issues. And as we'll see next week, there may be certain circumstances under which authority and a boss, you know, even if it's a Steve Carell kind of boss, may actually add value. Okay, one other point that I'll make just sort of in passing, I don't want to make a big deal of it, but you often hear people say that, well, Coase's transaction cost framework is itself kind of inconsistent with Austrian economics. People have asked me, somebody asked me on a blog today, and someone had asked me earlier in the chat room here, if Austrian economics, Rothbard in particular, rejected the concept of transaction cost because it's maybe objective instead of subjective. I think the answer is no, that Austrian economics is not inconsistent with the notion of transaction cost properly understood. I mean, yes, of course, the quantitative expression of a transaction cost, just as would be the case with any cost, production cost, transportation cost, whatever, right, are ultimately opportunity costs, and they can only be they have to be interpreted subjectively by a decision-making entrepreneur, right? They don't exist on their own. I mean, that's all true, but that does not invalidate the notion of transaction cost as we've been discussing it today. And I've got a couple of quotes here on my slide. I think the Rothbard quote is in my 96 article too, where here's Israel Kirzner and Murray Rothbard both taking a very, very explicitly Coasean perspective, right, where Kirzner talks about, you know, advantages of so-called central planning purchased at the price of an enhanced knowledge problem. This is sort of a Hayekian spin on Coase, right? We may expect firms to spontaneously expand to the point where the additional advantages of so-called central planning, meaning internal coordination, are just offset by the incremental knowledge difficulties that stem from dispersed information. This is Kirzner taking Coase's, the framework from Coase's 1937 article, and sort of incorporating Hayekian knowledge problems on top of it, layering Hayek's knowledge problems on top of Coase's general framework. And then Rothbard is even more explicit, right, summarizing Coase, and Rothbard saying, you know, our thesis, meaning Rothbard's thesis, you know, adds that the costs of internal corporate planning become prohibitive as soon as markets for capital goods begin to disappear, so that the free market optimum will always stop well short, not only of one big firm, but also of the disappearance of specific markets and so forth. But Rothbard says this is, you know, an addition or an addendum to the basic framework laid out by Coase in 1937. Okay, as I mentioned, I have some wonderful slides on diversification, which I'm just going to skip because we're running out of time here, but we can talk about them in the Q&A if you want. I'll just skip to my sort of concluding slide, and then we'll go through some of the questions that you guys have asked and really talk about whatever you want. Oh, sorry, we'll do one thing first and then we'll conclude. Last thing before we conclude is let me address very briefly the more general role of government intervention and the size of the firm. This is worth mentioning because there is a strand of thought within the Austrian tradition that sort of takes a view that, well, you know, all sort of corporate hierarchies and maybe even the corporation itself as a legal concept that these are all sort of artificial and hostile to the free market per se, that the only reason we have large firms, the only reason we have vertically integrated firms or diversified firms, the only reason we have the corporate form of organization, the joint stock company, is because of artificial intervention in the market by the state. One of the best known proponents of this view is Kevin Carson, a very interesting and thoughtful writer who has written some articles and shorter essays on the view that, you know, the large firm is itself inherently somehow hostile to the free market. And if we really had a pure free market with no government intervention whatsoever, we would only have small firms, sort of household production or cottage production, maybe some worker-owned cooperatives, but we would not have shareholder-owned firms. We wouldn't have large firms that try to exploit economies of scale and so forth. I think that literature is very interesting, and I'm sympathetic to Carson's point of view, but I think the basic argument is not quite correct for the following reason, that it is true that in the contemporary mixed economy, there are a lot of government policies that tend to bias firms in the direction of being larger rather than smaller, that make firms larger than they would otherwise be on the free market, right? So, interacting with the state involves some fixed costs, right? I mean, you have to have some basic knowledge of how the state works. You have to have a public relations firm, and you have to have lawyers and accountants that help you comply with all the regulations and complete all your tax forms and engage in lobbying and manage your IP portfolio and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, a small firm cannot afford to have a big legal and public relations staff and a government lobbying staff, right? Whereas large firms can more easily afford to have these things. Sometimes there are direct grants by the government to large companies. And there are also the sorts of things that Carson emphasizes, a lot of indirect subsidies, you know, the government-owned railroads and the government-subsidized interstate highway system, government-subsidized transportation networks of other sorts. These are ways of sort of transferring to the taxpayer the costs of facilitating economies of scale. So Carson argues that, you know, in the modern economy, the reason you can have a huge manufacturing facility that then ships the stuff to a big Walmart distribution center that centralizes all the logistics and then takes the stuff to these superstores located around the world, is only because the government has subsidized the cost of transportation as well as, you know, these legal and regulatory costs and lobbying costs and so forth. If Walmart had to pay the full cost of getting its stuff on the roads and on ships and on the railroads and so forth, then it would find it's much too costly to do that, and that you would have to have production and distribution and consumption geographically close. Right. I mean, if you're in Auburn, Alabama, you would have the styrofoam cups would have to be manufactured somewhere close to Auburn, Alabama, by local workers who live in Auburn. We'd have much smaller scale and more geographically local kinds of production. Like I say, I mean, there's certainly some truth in that argument. But again, we have to weigh that against a whole host of other government regulations and interventions that bias production in the favor of smaller firms, right? In many ways, there are other kinds of government activities that penalize size and subsidize small firms, right? I mean, the antitrust code, of course, antitrust enforcement is disproportionately levied against large firms rather than small firms. Politicians try to, you know, extract bribes, not only physical bribes, but sort of less explicit bribes in the form of campaign contributions from large firms rather than small firms. What Fred McChesney has called rent extraction, right? It's the big firms that are held up by the government. Either you donate to our campaigns or we'll regulate your industry out of existence, not the small local, you know, cottage enterprises. There are all kinds of disclosure requirements that small firms are exempt from, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley kinds of rules that make firms stay small and stay private rather than, you know, going public on the stock market. There are lots of direct subsidies that go to small firms. And there are a lot of indirect subsidies, too. I mean, you could argue that tariffs and other trade barriers, you know, the fact that governments engage in warfare, you know, state control of education, I mean, all of these things limit the international division of labor beyond what it would be on a purely free market. They limit the skills and knowledge that workers have. They make labor less effective than it otherwise might be. All of these things sort of reduce the kind of scale and scope economies that could potentially favor large-scale production. So my point is, theoretically, right, there are reasons why government intervention might make firms larger than they would otherwise be, but there are also reasons that government intervention might make firms smaller than they would otherwise be. And what is the net effect? You know, that's really an empirical question that we can only answer by looking at, you know, doing case studies and, you know, maybe performing the experiment of having a purely free global economy and sort of, you know, sort of to see what happens. So I don't think it's, I don't find it convincing. I don't find convincing the argument, well, just look at Walmart. The only reason they're there and they're profitable is because they are propped up by the state. I don't think that's the case at all. I think firms like Walmart in many ways are more hurt by the state than they benefit from the state. But again, it varies by company, it varies by industry, it varies over time, it varies across country, and so forth. I don't think we can make any general sweeping statements of the kind that, you know, folks like Kevin Carson would like to make. Okay, so takeaways from our discussion today. you know, we can approach the issue of firm boundaries using basic economics. Firm boundaries can be analyzed and understood using basic economics. All forms of organization, large-scale production, small-scale production, vertical integration, outsourcing, you know, no form of organization is perfect. All forms impose particular benefits and costs, again, subjectively interpreted benefits and costs, and only entrepreneurs can, the only way to figure out what's the sort of optimal size or scale or scope or whatever is by allowing entrepreneurs to experiment with different combinations of heterogeneous assets. So what we would expect out of that in a market economy is a lot of diversity, lots of different kinds of organizations, some small, some large, some vertically integrated, some vertically specialized. And we would expect a lot of churn, right? Frequent changes in firm boundaries, firms changing what they do, and firms going bankrupt and new firms coming into the picture. We need to think seriously about capital heterogeneity, like Williamson's concept of relationship-specific investment, which I think can be grounded more thoroughly, if we wanted to, in Austrian capital theory, right? And the idea from Mises and Rothbard that the calculation problem is not just about socialism. It's about economic organization more generally, and it has implications for vertical integration and conglomeration and so forth as well. I have some takeaways about diversification, but I'll skip those since we didn't have time to talk about diversification in our lecture. You know, my conclusion from that analysis, and, you know, you can get it from the Mitchell Berlin article, for example, is that, again, you know, like vertical integration, diversification per se is neither good nor bad. I mean, it has advantages, it has disadvantages. And under particular circumstances and particular contexts, the pros outweigh the cons, and a firm should become a related diversifier or maybe even an unrelated diversifier. But in other circumstances, it makes more sense for the firm to remain more specialized. Okay. Well, thanks to all of you for your patience. Let me look through some of your questions and excuse me. Let's see if I can add any insight to some of these great points that you guys have made. Let's see. I'm just going to scroll through the comments a little bit here and find the best ones to answer. Let's see. Okay, so yeah, there's, again, questions about transaction costs. As I said before, I don't think, I mean, look, Ronald Coase was not an Austrian economist. Oliver Williamson is not an Austrian economist. And there are a lot of Austrian critiques that can be made and have been made about their analysis. But, you know, for what we're talking about here, the general framework for understanding firm boundaries offered by Coase, Williamson's general theory of vertical integration, I think, you know, is perfectly consistent with, you know, Austrian concepts. Let's see. There's a couple questions about Rothbard's theory, right? So question from Malcolm, is Rothbard saying that uncertainty increases exponentially versus linearly with regard to the length of vertical integration? And can the same be said for conglomeration? I mean, I don't know whether I want to commit to a specific distribution, an exponential versus a linear distribution, but I mean, Rothbard is simply saying that as internal markets disappear, you know, the ability to perform economic calculation becomes impaired, and you know, the extent to which a firm's activities are internally linked means that there would be some sort of spillover effects, and so that incalculability, you know, in one area of my firm's activities might spill over into other areas of what I do. So there might be not just a linear effect, but some greater than linear effect. You know, whether it's exponential or not, I'm not sure. But yeah, I'm happy to agree that it's not just a small problem. And I think what Rothbard is trying to say, yeah, I mean, in the beginning, these islands of incalculability may be small, they may not be that big of a deal, but they quickly become larger and more difficult and more problematic. And, you know, so that means that the entrepreneur quickly finds that, hey, you know, we've internalized too much. We need to spin some activities, you know, back out. Let's see. Good comments about some examples of integration, Apple and so forth. Here's a question. Let's see. Okay, yeah, it's a good question about the state intervention points that I made. Let's see, can we get some articles arguing from an Austrian point of view that the corporation is a state created and supported entity? I mean, I'm gonna crowdsource that and say yes. Those of you who are interested in that, if you have some articles that you can share, please post them in the discussion board. I talked about this a little bit in a previous Mises Academy course that I did on big business, called Big Business and the Corporation. My view is that, in a nutshell, it is not the case that the limited liability company is per se sort of an illegitimate state intervention, right? And remember that there are two issues related to limited liability. There's limited liability in the sort of financial creditor sense, right? So I think everybody agrees, and probably Carson and people like that would agree, that if I'm setting a company and I go to some funders and I want them to invest in my company, you know, we can negotiate as part of the financial agreement who will be liable for what kind of financial damage, right? So if I go bankrupt, you know, can the bank go after the shareholders' personal assets or not? I mean, that can all be negotiated on the market as part of the contract between the entrepreneur and the bank, and the entrepreneur and the investor. And there's no reason that on a free market, you know, firms could not, you know, the bank would simply ask me, hey, before we give you this loan, what is your contract with your shareholders about who has to pay for what? And if I say, oh, well, I gave my shareholders limited liability, I told them that they would be exempt from liability for, you know, any debts that I incur, then, you know, the bank might say, oh, well, in that case, forget it. We're not going to make a loan to you, right? Maybe some other bank would say, okay, yes, we will lend to you, but that's very risky for us, and so we're going to charge you a very high interest rate, right? So limited liability in that case would presumably increase the firm's cost of capital. But if there's some advantages to doing it that way, I mean, there's no reason why the firm, you know, wouldn't be able to. The trickier issue from the point of view of sort of political economy is the issue of limited liability for torts, right? So whether if the company does some harm, you know, the chemical spill. If my company puts chemicals in the ground and that causes, you know, cancer to people who live nearby but on their own private property or whatever, so that a tort has been committed against those homeowners, can the shareholders be held liable for that? The argument that a lot of libertarians have made is that, yes, the shareholders should be liable. And the fact that under current statutory, you know, most incorporation statutes, the state has said the shareholders are not liable for torts, you know, that's, again, a state privilege for the firm, and that's the only reason why we have corporations, because they get the state privilege. There are two problems with that argument. One is that the limited liability of shareholders against tort claims is a very old kind of common law. That's part of the common law that predates formal state incorporation statutes. So even in the absence of the state, you know, when disputes had to be negotiated just sort of in very informal local community kinds of dispute resolution processes, the tradition was to exempt certain kinds of investors from those tort liability claims. Second problem is that from the point of view of sort of you know, jurisprudence and legal theory, it's not obvious why the shareholders should be liable for torts committed by agents of the shareholders, right? So the view that the shareholders should be, in the absence of state protection, liable for torts assumes some particular doctrines about when somebody is legally liable for what their subordinates do. And so the argument is, you know, if I hire Bob Murphy, if I got a pizza joint and I hire Bob Murphy to deliver a pizza, and our employment relationship is such that, you know, I say, Bob, you have to drive within the speed limit, you have to drive safely, you have to do this, you have to do that. And then Bob, on his own initiative, right, contrary to the agreement that Bob and I had negotiated, you know, speeds and drives recklessly and causes an accident and causes harm. I mean, from the point of view of libertarian theory, clearly Bob is responsible for the harm that he's caused, but it's not obvious why I should be legally liable for what somebody did in my on my behalf when they were acting contrary to my specific instructions, right? So I think one would have to provide an argument for why, you know, in principal agent language, the principal should be legally liable for all acts committed by the agent, to claim that in the absence of state protection, shareholders would always have to pay for all of the torts committed by the firm. So it may be that the, you know, state incorporation statutes are simply codifying something that we would already have in the absence of the state, and that we did have under the common law in the absence, you know, before these kind of incorporation statutes came about. Again, this is sort of a hot issue among libertarian legal theorists, and may be of interest to some of you, but, you know, may not be of interest to others. Okay, just a couple more questions before we wrap up. Let's see. Does it follow that the more complex the product or service offered by the firm, the higher the transaction cost of production, and thereby a larger firm is needed for internal coordination? I mean, I don't think that would be a direct implication of Coase's theory or Williamson's theory or Mises or Rothbard's theory or my theory of the firm or a theory of entrepreneurship. You know, whether the transaction costs of producing a product on the market are high, it depends on the amount of negotiation that must take place. I mean, so there may be a very complex device that is produced, but, you know, there are lots of people who can produce it. I mean, let me think of an example. You know, say the memory chip on a smartphone. I mean, if that's what I mean, you know, a memory chip is a pretty complicated thing. You know, it's got integrated circuits in it, and, you know, and you or I couldn't build one with our hands. I mean, that is a highly technologically complex component. But if it's the case that there are, you know, 100 firms that know how to make these little memory chips, and it's a very standardized thing within the industry, then the complexity of the chip does not by itself have any specific implication for whether I should procure it on the market, you know, spot market, whether I should have a long-term contract with some vendor, or whether I should produce it in-house. I mean, that has to do with the number of potential suppliers, how difficult it is to write contracts with them, you know, what's the holdup risk to me if I don't produce it myself? What are the managerial costs of trying to organize that thing inside and so forth? I mean, there may be a relationship between the complexity of the component and these and the relevant transaction costs, but it's not a direct kind of one-to-one kind of relationship. Okay, last question before we stop. Let me just read this. One instructor at Mises said the Nobel Prize Committee may have waited until Mises passed away before awarding the prize to Hayek. So this is a question about why Mises didn't get the Nobel Prize. Does it have something to do with the fact that maybe Mises didn't explicitly generalize his argument to, you know, issues about the firm and vertical integration the way that Rothbard did, and maybe didn't make as many applications as Hayek did later? I mean, frankly, I don't know. Who knows how the Nobel Prize Committee makes the decisions that it does? I mean, who in their right mind would think that Paul Krugman, of all people, would merit a Nobel Prize? You know, some of it's political, some of it's who you know. I mean, it may very well, but let me put it this way. The fact that Mises died in 1973 and his best-known kind of younger disciple got the Nobel Prize the very next year, I mean, it looks kind of suspicious, but I mean, we don't have any direct documentary evidence to suspect that there was some kind of a conspiracy to wait until Mises died. But, I mean, it is the case that Hayek's ideas are much better known in the strategy literature and in the organization theory literature than Mises' ideas, though in many ways Hayek is sort of building on insights that were offered by Mises. So, okay, lots more great discussion that we could have, but we need to respect our time and call a close to the formal proceedings now. But please, let's continue this discussion in the chat room on Moodle, on the discussion boards, discussion forums on Moodle, and I'll be happy to jump in and answer any questions that I can. But, you know, it's really best for you guys to answer each other's questions as best you can. There's lots of good ideas and lots of important things that we've just sort of barely touched on. In particular, if there are anything in the readings, if there's anything in the readings that doesn't make sense, don't hesitate to ask for clarification there. So, again, great being with all of you, and I will see you at the same time and same place next week. Bye-bye.